only program that has the courage to get on some subjects nobody else gets on. For some time now, people have been saying to me, what about reincarnation? Do you believe in it? Well, the answer is no. I believe absent from the body for the Christian is present with Christ. But unlike some preachers, I don't put people down who hold different views. I'm still mad about what I heard Sunday night by a TV evangelist. I think every person in the Los Angeles area ought to sit down and write a letter tonight and tomorrow to every V station in Los Angeles. Tell them what you think of those other religious programs they got on and ask them why they don't put me on to balance the scale. Los Angeles has got on every V station some of the wildest stuff I've ever heard in the name of God. And I'm still mad at that evangelist taking a document written by a very extreme non-representative view of the women who supported ERA, and what I think of ERA is my business. But everybody deserves fair shucks. They need to hear something decent. And to say that all women who supported ERA are reflected in the document this evangelist read is as bad as that dastardly deed of blaming the Jews for the Protocols of Zion. The Protocols of Zion do not reflect the Jews. Probably wasn't even written by one. Yet it's been used to abuse the Jews. And that document an evangelist was reading, conveying the impression it was representative of all women who stand for ERA, was simply not fair. I think, you hear me? I think every person in Los Angeles listening to me that believes you ought to be able to talk about God with some intelligence ought to write every V station in town. Just sit down and do it tomorrow. And say, if you're going to carry all that other crap, why don't you put Scott in to clean up the mess when it's done? Now, people have been saying, when are you going to get on reincarnation? Well, I said, we'll see, won't we? Get my budget problem solved, I can do what I've been doing. Keep right on teaching. We got lots of things to cover. People say, what about Nostradamus? Well, I'm going to teach on him. He had a better ratio than Gene Dixon. Well, what about reincarnation? Well, what about it? A lot of people believe in it. When you listen to one of these redneck TV evangelists get on the subject, they'll say, they'll belittle it, say anyone believe in it's ignorant, put it down. We'll tackle anything. See, I believe that if you've got a faith in God that's right, you can handle anything. You know, you don't have to be afraid of any kind of philosophy. I studied Buddhism under Dr. Kishimoto, who took Anasaki's place as a leading Buddhist scholar in the Far East. Now here's a book that's just come out. Sylvia Cranston and Kerry Williams, Reincarnation, A New Horizon in Science, Religion, and Society. You won't hear this on any other person's program. Christianity better be ready to handle things like this. Let me read you one. What'd you stop answering the phone for? Phone ringing? What'd they quit calling for? Now, you haven't given me my budget yet. What makes you think that you can just stop like that and I'll start teaching? I ain't got near enough calls tonight to get me motivated. When Dr. Stevenson was in Brazil in 1962 investigating a case, he met an immigrant from Lebanon who said that in his native village, Conail, there were many cases of rebirth. Now this is going to shake some people up tonight. How about Edgar Cayce, people say? Well, I'm going to teach on him. I've been spending the last year, you know, rather thoroughly dealing with the lost tribes, trying to catch people up that weren't caught up, and I have spoiled you. I stayed on one subject so long, you just spoiled. I haven't dangled anything in so long. I'm laying awake at night, feeling miserable over it. The man provided Stevenson with a card of introduction to his brother there. But it was not until 2 years later that the doctor could visit the place. So one day in early March of 1964, without advance warning, he suddenly appeared, only to learn that the brother had escaped the cold winter of the mountainous area and was spending the winter in Beirut. When the villagers learned of Stevenson's mission, they told him of a five-year-old boy, Imad Elawar, who had been incessantly talking about his former life since the age of one. Really want to say to you is that they're the people who believe in reincarnation have assembled an awful lot of evidence for their belief, and there are some phenomena that need explanation from the Christian frame. Now, philosophy of life doesn't orient all of your life, it's not worth much. Why should a Christian preacher be scared of this? This was not a matter of astonishment to the natives. They were familiar with such revelations. In fact, Stevenson relates that among these people, who are not Muslims but members of the Druze religion, the incidence of reincarnation cases is among the highest in the world. Which, by the way, may explain why they don't really worry too much about shooting one another up. Considering their circumstances, anything next time would be better. In a lot of cases. But 200,000 existing Druzes live mainly in Lebanon, Syria, northern Israel, and Jordan. Quite a few have now immigrated to the United States and Brazil. Stevenson located the father of Imad and found he was the cousin of his friend in Brazil. The case turned out to be one of his strongest and is especially valuable because he was able to investigate it before the two families involved, past and present, knew of each other's existence. Dropping in out of the blue, he was able to freshly examine the behavior of the boy at home, and also when he first met his supposed former relatives. Consequently, before any attempt was made to locate these people, Stevenson recorded over 50 items the child said he remembered. 5 years old. Now for the story itself. Emmett was born December 21st, 1958. And when he began to speak, the first words he said were the names Jamila and Mahmoud. As he became more fluent, he soon revealed many facts about his prior life. The names of people he formerly knew, the property he owned, and some of the events of his life. He recalled being a member of the Buhamzi family that lived in Krivi, a village separated by Conail by a 25-mile winding mountainous road. Some of you out there are going to laugh. That reminds me of that redneck preaching Sunday with a host of rednecks, not intelligent to even intelligent enough to even mimic the dumbness of their mentor. Laughing as he put down everything that he was too ignorant to understand. I believe in respecting people's opinions. Taking them into account and letting my faith stand the test. I'm telling you, if this is true, and I kind of believe it is, we better have a Christian explanation for this. I don't believe in reincarnation. I believe Christian dies, he's in heaven. I don't believe in soul sleeping. But I got to deal with these illustrations. Among his present family, only his father had ever visited Creeby, and this was on the occasion of a prominent Druze's funeral. Imad would talk to himself about the people whose names he mentioned and ask aloud how these people were getting along, 5 years old. He also spoke of these things in his sleep. There were 14 names of individuals he mentioned, but the one he spoke about most was Jamila, whose beauty he raved about, comparing it with that of his more unattractive mother. Jamila, he said, wore red clothes that he had bought for her. She wore high heels, unusual even today among women in her village. Enid's mother reported that when he was about 3 years old, his longing for Jamila reached its height. I ain't going to read what he asked his mother to do. I mean, I embarrass easily. I'm going to skip that part. Among his other memories was his fondness for hunting. He had a rifle in that previous life and also had a double-barreled shotgun. He said, to describe the latter, he held two fingers together. Among other property, he owned a house, which he described, a small yellow car, a bus, and a truck that hauled rock. You love Jesus. Among events in his former life, he remembered beating a dog. But the one thing that bothered him most was a serious accident in which a truck ran over a man, broke his legs, and crushed his trunk. The man, said Emmett, was taken... What am I surrounded by, a bunch of sadists here tonight? The man, said Emmett, was taken to the doctor's place and had an operation. To Emmett's mother and grandmother, this revelation seemed particularly significant, because when the child first learned to walk, he constantly exclaimed how wonderful it was to be able to walk again. What were you all drinking before I arrived? His father discounted all these stories, just like you are, and called the child a liar. Thereafter, the son spoke of such matters only among the female members of his family. However, everyone took notice one day when 2-year-old Imid, stopping a complete stranger on the street, joyously threw his arms around him. The startled man exclaimed, "Do you know me?" "Yes, you were my neighbor." The man was Salim El Ashkar, a native of Creeby. He once lived close to Imid's former house, a fact that was only discovered later, for at this point no one knew which Buhamzi family the boy really belonged to. However, this did not prevent his present family from coming to rather definite conclusions, but quite incorrect conclusions, as we shall see. Thus, in the beginning, Dr. Stevenson was given some very misleading clues. Here is the story the parents had pieced together. As the first words the child had spoken as a baby were Mahmoud and Jamili, they must have been the names of himself and his wife. Mahmoud must have been killed by a truck. This seemed to be confirmed not only by Enid's recall of the accident, but because as a child he had a notable phobia for large trucks and buses. Even as a toddler, he'd run and hide from them. With little more to go on, Stevenson, accompanied by Enid and his father, went to Creeby the next day. The child was in ecstasy, as he had been nagging his parents to take him there for years. En route, the boy made a number of additional statements to Stevenson regarding his memories, but the visit turned up nothing consequential in solving the mystery of Emid's claimed pre-life history. Yes, they discovered a Mahmud Ruhamzi did exist. In fact, he was very much alive. His wife was not called Jamili, and the description of his house did not conform to Emid's description. So, Stevenson decided to leave the father and son behind the following day and make some preliminary investigations of his own in Creevy. He located the Buhamzi by the name of Hafez, whose father had been run over by a truck that broke his legs and crushed his trunk. And despite two operations... I mean, crushed trunks really turn you on, don't they? I don't think you want me to continue with this story. Despite two operations performed that very day, he had lost his life. However, the dead man's wife was not called Jamili, and his house did not match Emmett's description. So Stevenson's research again dissolved into nothing. Then, suddenly, light dawned. Hafez reveals, then, suddenly, light dawned. Hafez revealed that. Then, suddenly, light dawned. Hafez. Now, we got to figure out who Hafez. Yes, Buhamzi. Right now I'm teaching on reincarnation. Don't believe in it. Don't believe in reincarnation myself. But I don't like people who put down other people's beliefs. I am the other voice for Christianity. That tolerant voice that believes that God's got something to do besides look for people having a good time so I can put a stop to it. That God has something to do other than send out lame brains every Sunday to dump on us for all of our sins that they know very little about. I'm the alternate that believes you don't have to park your brains at the door of a church to be a Christian. I'm the alternate that believes I don't have to save the world by sundown, and I don't try to convert anybody. I just teach. I'd like people to understand their faith. I am a pastor. People come to my church that are of different faiths, and I happen to be teaching on reincarnation right now. I don't believe in it, but I respect the evidence for it. And there is a lot of solid evidence for it. And some very important, intelligent, and famous people have researched it and believe in it. And it does nothing as a Christian to belittle it. You better have your faith capable of embracing it and giving an explanation for it that respects the evidence but allows an alternative interpretation to those who believe in reincarnation. And I was right in the middle of reading an amazing evidentiary testimony in Lebanon to reincarnation. The testimonial researched in a five-year-old boy's life. I was at a certain point in this book. Reincarnation, a new horizon in science, religion, and society. Then suddenly light dawned. That's where I was, wasn't it? Hafez revealed that. And then I quit. I'm going to stay quit. Salisbury, North Carolina. What is a Gideon? They either tithe or give $100 a month to this ministry. How do you become one? You make up your mind and you call and say, I'm going to be a Gideon and this is what I'm going to send in. Just that simple. Now turn the lights down while I answer the phone. Let me read. I'm in, did the Apostle Paul visit Britain? Last night, we read the introduction to the 29th chapter of Acts, discovered by Sunini. And a brief synopsis of Caradoc, the Silurian king to move the Roman Senate to grant him house arrest, parole, in Rome, and that was the Christian household that Paul wrote the Roman letter to and which Paul visited. Chapter 3 picks up where I left off last night. Having thus established the British king and his family in Titulus, that's the household of the Silurian king, we turn our attention to St. Paul, who arrived at Rome for the first time on his appeal to Caesar, A.D. 58. A strong Christian church, celebrated for its zeal and fidelity, existed in Rome before the visit of St. Paul or any other apostle to it. Keep right on answering the phone in here, and answer it at King's House 2 also. I can read this book with you talking on the phone. We know from many passages in the Epistle to the Romans itself that at the time of its composition, that is, the letter Paul wrote to the Romans, at the time of its composition and dispatch, Paul had not yet been to Rome. Amongst the members of the church, however, now you're going to hear some things that have been left out of most church history classes. Amongst the members of the church, however, were some, not only of the most intimate fellow laborers and friends, but actual relatives of the Apostle Paul. Some of the latter, such as Andronicus and Junia, had been converted before him. Herodian is mentioned as another kinsman. Now, what are all these kinfolk of Paul doing in Rome at this British household? In connection with Rufus Pudens, who is saluted by name, occurs another salutation which originates an interesting question, the right solution of which would throw a flood of light on this part of the history both of Paul and Pudens. Paul in Romans 16 says, quote, "Salute Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and his mother and mine." Does this mean natural mother or a spiritual relationship? This author, this man, me, inclined to believe the former, natural mother. A spiritual father or mother is, in gospel phraseology, the person who converts another to Christ. St. Paul's conversion was effected by Christ himself by a direct miracle, so he had no reason to refer to Rufus's mother as some kind of spiritual mother. With respect to him, the terms could not be applied to any human being. Was then the mother of Rufus the mother also of Paul? Were Rufus and Paul half-brothers? The latter, the elder, by a Hebrew, the former, the younger, by a second marriage with a Gentile or a proselyte Roman. This mother, also the mother of Paul, was a Christian, living with Rufus, and is termed also his mother by St. Paul. In the palace of Rufus, when at Rome, Paul spent most of his time there, though he had his own hired house. The children of Claudia and Pudens, the one who had the same mother as Paul, as we learn from the Roman martyrologies, were brought up on Paul's knees. And we find in the last scene of his life, preceding his martyrdom, the only salutations sent by him to Timothy to be those of Eubulus, Claudia, Linus, and Pudens, the same family ministering and attending to him up to the very last. There is, whichever way we decide, a closeness and a connection between the apostle and the family of Pudens which has hitherto escaped observation, seldom is treated in church history, and remains to be explained. And this continued even after the death of Paul. For the children of Pudens, all of whom suffered martyrdom, were interred by the side of the apostle, as in a common family cemetery, on the Via Ostiensis. Leaving the question of the nature of this affinity in abeyance, we now observe, 1, that Pudens was converted before St. Paul came to Rome and by some other Christian than Paul. That Hermas' pastor appears at this very early date to have been the pastor at the Titulus, which constituted the place of meeting for the Gentile church, which was the home of the Silurian king, the daughter of whom had been married to Rufus Pudens. The Hebrew church, or the church of circumcision, met at the house of Aquila and Priscilla. That's clear in Romans 16:5. The Gentile church met in the house of Caradoc. 3, that the household of Aristobulus is greeted, but Aristobulus himself is not, being absent at the time from Rome. Hence arise the questions, who were the evangelizers of the family of Claudia Britannica and Pudens? And where was Aristobulus absent? Was it in Britain? Was Britain evangelized in any degree before St. Paul came to Rome? And if so, by whom? An investigation of utmost importance. Am I boring you? The fairest way of treating the subject of the first introduction of Christianity into Britain seems to be to lay down an affirmative statement, adduce what evidence there is in support of it, and leave the reader to draw the conclusion whether it makes good such statements or not. We write as investigators, not as dogmatists. But our propositions must of necessity often assume the affirmative form, or we should be mere negationists of history. So here's our statement. Christianity was first introduced into Britain by Joseph of Arimathea, AD 36 to 39, followed by Simon the Zealot, the Apostle, then by Aristobulus, the first bishop of the Britons, then by Paul. Its first converts were members of the royal family of Siluria, that is, Gladys, the sister of Caradoc, Gladys, whose name was changed on adoption by the Emperor Claudius to Claudia, and Eurgen, his daughters. Linus, his son, converted in Britain before they were carried into captivity to Rome, then Caradoc, Bran, and the rest of the family converted at Rome. The two cradles of Christianity in Britain were Inniswydren, the Crystal Isle, translated by the Saxons, Glastonbury, in Somersetshire, where Joseph settled and taught, and Siluria, where the earliest churches and schools, next to Inniswydren, were founded by the Silurian dynasty. Now, for the consecutive evidences of this statement. They've been collected at the cost of much research from various quarters. Are you interested? The evidence for the statement just made. The constant current of European tradition affirmed Britain to have been the first country in Europe which received the gospel, and the British church to be the most ancient of the churches of Christ therein. The universality of this opinion is readily demonstrated. 1. Well, I think I'm going to quit.